forever and the earth. After 70 years of writing short stories that never sold, Mr. Henry William Field arose one night at 11:30 and burned 10 million words. He carried the manuscripts downstairs through his dark old mansion and threw them into the furnace. "That's that," he said, and thinking about his lost art and his misspent life, he put himself to bed among his rich antiques. "My mistake was in ever trying to picture this wild world of A.D. 2257. The rockets, the atom wonders, the travels to planets and double suns. Nobody could do it. Everyone's tried. All of our modern authors have failed." Space was too big for them, and rockets too swift, and atomic science too instantaneous, he thought. But at least the other writers, while failing, had been published, while he, in his idle wealth, had used the years of his life for nothing. After an hour of feeling this way, he fumbled through the night rooms to his library and switched on a green hurricane lamp. At random, from a collection untouched in 50 years, he selected a book. It was a book 3 centuries yellow and 3 centuries brittle, but he settled into it and read hungrily until dawn. At 9 the next morning, Henry William Field staggered from his library, called his servants, televised lawyers, scientists, litterateurs.
"Come at once," he cried.
By noon, a dozen people had stepped into the study where Henry William Field sat, very disreputable and hysterical with an odd, feeding joy, unshaven and feverish. He clutched a thick book in his brittle arms and laughed if anyone even said good morning.
"Here you see a book," he said at last, holding it out, "written by a giant, a man born in Asheville, North Carolina, in the year 1900. Long gone to dust, he published 4 huge novels. He was a whirlwind. He lifted up mountains and collected winds. He left a trunk of penciled manuscripts behind when he lay in bed at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore in the year 1938, on September 15th, and died of pneumonia, an ancient and awful disease."
They looked at the book. "Look Homeward, Angel." He drew forth 3 more. "Of Time and the River," "The Web and the Rock," "You Can't Go Home Again."
"By Thomas Wolfe," said the old man. 3 centuries cold in the North Carolina earth."
"You mean you've called us simply to see 4 books by a dead man?"
his friend protested.
"More than that, I've called you because I feel Tom Wolfe the man, the necessary man to write of space, of time, huge things like nebulae and galactic war, meteors and planets. All the dark things he loved and put on paper were like this. He was born out of his time. He needed really big things to play with and never found them on Earth. He should have been born this afternoon instead of 100,000 mornings ago."
"I'm afraid you're a bit late," said Professor Bolton.
"I don't intend to be late," snapped the old man. "I will not be frustrated by reality. You, Professor, have experimented with time travel. I expect you to finish your time machine as soon as possible. Here's a check, a blank check. Fill it in. If you need more money, ask for it. You've done some traveling already, haven't you?"
"A few years, yes, but nothing like centuries."
"We'll make it centuries, you others!"
He swept them with a fierce and shining glance.
"We'll work with Bolton. I must have Thomas Wolfe."
"What?" They fell back before him.
"Yes," he said. "That's the plan. Wolfe is to be brought to me. We will collaborate in the task of describing the flight from Earth to Mars, as only he could describe it."
They left him in his library with his books, turning the dry pages, nodding to himself.
"Yes. Oh, dear Lord, yes. Tom's the boy. Tom is the very boy for this."
The months passed slowly. Days showed a maddening reluctance to leave the calendar, and weeks lingered on until Mr. Henry William Field began to scream silently. At the end of 4 months, Mr. Field awoke one midnight. The phone was ringing. He put his hand out in the darkness.
"Yes?"
"This is Professor Bolton calling."
"Yes, Bolton?"
"I'll be leaving in an hour," said the voice.
"Leaving? Leaving where? Are you quitting? You can't do that!"
"Please, Mr. Field, leaving means leaving."
"You mean you're actually going?"
"Within the hour."
"To 1938? To September 15th?
"Yes."
"You're sure you've the date fixed correctly? You'll arrive before he dies? Be sure of it." "Good Lord, you'd better get there a good hour before his death, don't you think?"
2 hours. "On the way back, we'll mark time in Bermuda, borrow 10 days of free-floating continuum, inject him, tan him, swim him, vitaminize him, make him well."
"I'm so excited I can't hold the phone. Good luck, Bolton. Bring him through safely."
"Thank you, sir. Goodbye." The phone clicked.
Mr. Henry William Field lay through the ticking night. He thought of Tom Wolfe as a lost brother to be lifted intact from under a cold, chiseled stone, to be restored to blood and fire and speaking. He trembled each time he thought of Bolton whirling on the time wind back to other calendars and other days, bearing medicines to change flesh and save souls. "Tom," he thought faintly, in the half-awake warmth of an old man calling after his favorite and long-gone child. "Tom, where are you tonight, Tom? Come along now, we'll help you through. You've got to come. There's need for you." "I couldn't do it, Tom. None of us here can. So the next best thing to doing it myself, Tom, is helping you to do it. You can play with rockets like jackstraws, Tom, and you can have the stars like a handful of crystals. Anything your heart asks, it's here. You'd like the fire and the travel, Tom. It was made for you. Oh, we've a pale lot of writers today. I've read them all, Tom, and they're not like you. I've waded in libraries of their stuff, and they've never touched space, Tom. We need you for that. Give an old man his wish, then, for God knows I've waited all my life for myself or some other to write the really great book about the stars, and I've waited in vain. So wherever you are tonight, Tom Wolfe, make yourself tall. It's that book you were going to write. It's that good book the critics said was in you when you stopped breathing. Here's your chance. Will you do it, Tom? Will you listen and come through to us? Will you do that tonight and be here in the morning when I wake? Will you, Tom?" His eyelids closed down over the fever and the demand. His tongue stopped quivering in his sleeping mouth. The clock struck 4. Awakening to the white coolness of morning, he felt the excitement rising and welling in himself. He did not wish to blink for fear that the thing which awaited him somewhere in the house might run off and slam a door, gone forever. His hands reached up to clutch his thin chest. Far away, footsteps. A series of doors opened and shut. 2 men entered the bedroom. Field could hear them breathe. Their footsteps took on identities. The first steps were those of a spider, small and precise. Bolton. The second steps were those of a big man, a large man, a heavy man.
"Tom!"
cried the old man. He did not open his eyes.
"Yes,"
said a voice at last. Tom Wolfe burst the seams of Field's imagination, as a huge child bursts the lining of a too small coat.
"Tom Wolfe, let me look at you."
If Field said it once, he said it 12 times as he fumbled from bed, shaking violently.
"Put up the blinds, for God's sake. I want to see this. Tom Wolfe, is that you?"
Tom Wolfe looked down from his tall, thick body, with big hands out to balance himself in a world that was strange. He looked at the old man and the room, and his mouth was trembling.
You're just as they said you were, Tom.
Thomas Wolfe began to laugh, and the laughing was huge, for he must have thought himself insane or in a nightmare. And he came to the old man and touched him, and he looked at Professor Bolton and felt of himself, his arms and legs. He coughed experimentally and touched his own brow.
My fever's gone, he said. I'm not sick anymore.
Of course not, Tom.
What a night, said Tom Wolfe. It hasn't been easy. I thought I was sicker than any man ever was. I felt myself floating, and I thought, this is fever. I felt myself traveling, and I thought, I'm dying fast. A man came to me. I thought, this is the Lord's messenger. He took my hands. I smelled electricity. I flew up and over, and I saw a brass city. I thought, I've arrived. This is the city of heaven. There is the gate. I'm numb from head to toe, like someone left in the snow to freeze. I've got to laugh and do things, or I might think myself insane. You're not God, are you? You don't look like him.
The old man laughed.
No, no, Tom, not God, but playing at it. I'm Field.
He laughed again.
Lord, listen to me. I said it as if you should know who Field is. Field, the financier. Tom, bow low. Kiss my ring finger. I'm Henry Field. I like your work. I brought you here. Come along.
The old man drew him to an immense crystal window.
Do you see those lights in the sky, Tom?
Yes, sir.
Those fireworks?
Yes.
They're not what you think, son. It's not July 4th, Tom. Not in the usual way. Every day's Independence Day now. Man has declared his freedom from Earth. Gravitation without representation has been overthrown. The revolt has long since been successful. That green Roman candle's going to Mars. That red fire, that's the Venus rocket. And the others, you see the yellow and the blue? Rockets, all of them.
Thomas Wolfe gazed up like an immense child caught amid the colorized glories of a July evening when the set pieces are awhirl with phosphorus and glitter and barking explosion.
What year is this?
The year of the rocket. Look here.
And the old man touched some flowers that bloomed at his touch. The blossoms were like blue and white fire. They burned and sparkled their cold long petals. The blooms were 2 feet wide, and they were the color of an autumn moon.
Moon flowers, said the old man. From the other side of the moon.
He brushed them, and they dripped away into a silver rain, a shower of white sparks on the air.
The Year of the Rocket. That's a title for you, Tom. That's why we brought you here. We've need of you. You're the only man who could handle the sun without being burnt to a ridiculous cinder. We want you to juggle the sun, Tom, and the stars, and whatever else you see on your trip to Mars.
Mars?
Thomas Wolfe turned to seize the old man's arm, bending down to him, searching his face in unbelief.
Tonight, you leave at 6 o'clock.
The old man held a fluttering pink ticket on the air, waiting for Tom to think to take it. It was 5 in the afternoon.
Of course, I appreciate what you've done,
cried Thomas Wolfe.
Sit down, Tom. Stop walking around.
Let me finish, Mr. Field. Let me get through with this. I've got to say it.
We've been arguing for hours,
pleaded Mr. Field exhaustedly. They had talked from breakfast until lunch, until tea. They had wandered through 12 rooms and 10 arguments. They had perspired and grown cold and perspired again.
It all comes down to this, said Thomas Wolfe
at last.
I can't stay here, Mr. Field. I've got to go back. This isn't my time. You've no right to interfere.
But I...
I was deep in my work, my best yet to come, and now you run me off 3 centuries? Mr. Field, I want you to call Mr. Bolton back. I want you to have him put me in his machine, whatever it is, and return me to 1938, my rightful place and year. That's all I ask of you.
But don't you want to see Mars?
With all my heart. But I know it isn't for me. It would throw my writing off. I'd have a huge handful of experience that I couldn't fit into my other writing when I went home.
You don't understand, Tom. You don't understand at all.
I understand that you're selfish.
Selfish?
Yes, said the old man.
For myself and for others. Very selfish.
I want to go home.
Listen to me, Tom.
Call Mr. Bolton.
Tom, I don't want to have to tell you this. I thought I wouldn't have to, that it wouldn't be necessary. Now you leave me only this alternative.
The old man's right hand fetched hold of a curtained wall, swept back the drapes, revealing a large white screen, and dialed a number, a series of numbers. The screen flickered into vivid color. The lights of the room darkened, and a graveyard took line before their eyes.
"What are you doing?"
demanded Wolf, striding forward, staring at the screen.
"I don't like this at all," said the old man. "Look there."
The graveyard lay in mid-afternoon light, the light of summer. From the screen drifted the smell of summer earth, granite, and the odor of a nearby creek. From the trees a bird called. Red and yellow flowers nodded among the stones, and the screen moved. The sky rotated. The old man twisted a dial for emphasis, and in the center of the screen, growing large, coming closer, yet larger, and now filling their senses, was a dark granite mass, and Thomas Wolfe, looking up in the dim room, ran his eyes over the chiseled words once, twice, 3 times, gasped and read again, for there was his name, Thomas Wolfe, and the date of his birth and the date of his death, and the flowers and green ferns smelling sweetly on the air of the cold room.
"Turn it off," he said.
"I'm sorry, Tom."
"Turn it off, turn it off. I don't believe it."
"It's there."
The screen went black, and now the entire room was a midnight vault, a tomb with the last faint odor of flowers.
"I didn't wake up again," said Thomas Wolfe.
"No, you died that September of 1938. So you see. Oh, God, the ironies, it's like the title of your book. Tom, you can't go home again."
"I never finished my book."
"It was edited for you by others who went over it carefully."
"I didn't finish my work. I didn't finish my work."
"Don't take it so badly, Tom."
"How else can I take it?"
The old man didn't turn on the lights. He didn't want to see Tom there.
"Sit down, boy."
No reply.
"Tom?"
No answer.
"Sit down, son. Will you have something to drink?"
For answer, there was only a sigh and a kind of brutal mourning.
"Good Lord," said Tom. "It's not fair. I had so much left to do. It's not fair."
He began to weep, quietly.
"Don't do that," said the old man. "Listen, listen to me. You're still alive, aren't you? Here, now? You still feel, don't you?"
Thomas Wolfe waited for a minute, and then he said,
"Yes."
"All right, then."
The old man pressed forward on the dark air.
"I've brought you here. I've given you another chance, Tom, an extra month or so. Do you think I haven't grieved for you? When I read your book and saw your gravestone there, 3 centuries worn by rains and wind, boy, don't you imagine how it killed me to think of your talent gone away? Well, it did. It killed me, Tom.
and I spent my money to find a way to you. You've got a respite. Not long, not long at all. Professor Bolton says that with luck, he can hold the channels open through time for 8 weeks. He can keep you here that long, and only that long. In that interval, Tom, you must write the book you've wanted to write. No, not the book you were working on for them, son. No, for they're dead and gone, and it can't be changed. No, this time it's a book for us, Tom. For us, the living. That's the book we want. A book you can leave with us. For you. A book bigger and better in every way than anything you ever wrote. Say you'll do it, Tom. Say you'll forget about that stone and that hospital for 8 weeks and start to work for us. Will you, Tom? Will you? The lights came slowly on. Tom Wolfe stood tall at the window, looking out, his face huge and tired and pale. He watched the rockets on the sky of early evening.
I imagine I don't realize what you've done for me, he said. You've given me a little more time, and time is the thing I love most and need, the thing I always hated and fought against, and the only way I can show my appreciation is by doing as you say. He hesitated. And when I'm finished, then what?
Back to your hospital in 1938, Tom.
Must I?
We can't change time. We borrowed you for 5 minutes. We'll return you to your hospital cot 5 minutes after you left it. That way we upset nothing. It's all been written. You can't hurt us in the future by living here now with us. But if you refused to go back, you could hurt the past, and resultantly the future, make it into some sort of chaos.
8 weeks, said Thomas Wolfe.
8 weeks.
And the Mars rocket leaves in an hour?
Yes.
I'll need pencils and paper.
Here they are.
I'd better go get ready. Goodbye, Mr. Field.
Good luck, Tom.
6 o'clock. The sun setting. The sky turning to wine. The big house quiet. The old man shivering in the heat until Professor Bolton entered.
Bolton? How is he getting on? How was he at the port? Tell me.
Bolton smiled.
What a monster he is. So big they had to make a special uniform for him. You should have seen him walking around, lifting up everything, sniffing like a great hound, talking, his eyes looking at everyone, excited as a 10-year-old.
God bless him, oh God bless him.
Bolton, can you keep him here as long as you say?
Bolton frowned. He doesn't belong here, you know. If our power should falter, he'd be snapped back to his own time, like a puppet on a rubber band. We'll try and keep him, I assure you.
You've got to, you understand. You can't let him go back until he's finished with his book. You've...
Look, said Bolton. He pointed to the sky. On it was a silver rocket.
Is that him?
Asked the old man.
That's Tom Wolfe, replied Bolton. Going to Mars.
Give 'em hell, Tom! Give 'em hell!
Shouted the old man, lifting both fists. They watched the rocket fire into space. By midnight, the story was coming through. Henry William Field sat in his library. On his desk was a machine that hummed. It repeated words that were being written out beyond the moon. It scrawled them in black pencil, in facsimile of Tom Wolfe's fevered hand a million miles away. The old man waited for a pile of them to collect, and then he seized them and read them aloud to the room where Bolton and the servant stood listening. He read the words about space and time and travel, about a large man and a large journey, and how it was in the long midnight and coldness of space, and how a man could be hungry enough to take all of it and ask for more. He read the words that were full of fire and thunder and mystery. Space was like October, wrote Thomas Wolfe. He said things about its darkness and its loneliness, and man so small in it. The eternal and timeless October, was one of the things he said. And then he told of the rocket itself, the smell and the feel of the metal of the rocket, and the sense of destiny and wild exultancy to at last leave Earth behind, all problems and all sadnesses, and go seeking a bigger problem and a bigger sadness. Oh, it was fine writing, and it said what had to be said about space and man and his small rockets out there alone. The old man read until he was hoarse, and then Bolton read, and then the others far into the night, when the machine stopped transcribing words and they knew that Tom Wolfe was in bed then, on the rocket flying to Mars. Probably not asleep, no. He wouldn't sleep for hours yet, no. Lying awake, like a boy the night before a circus, not believing the big jeweled black tent is up and the circus is on, with 10 billion blazing performers on the high wires and the invisible trapezes of space.
There, breathed the old man, gentling aside the last pages of the first chapter. What do you think of that, Bolton?
It's good.
Good hell! Shouted Field. It's wonderful! Read it again. Sit down. Read it again, damn you!
It kept coming through, one day following another, for 10 hours at a time. The stack of yellow papers on the floor, scribbled on, grew immense in a week, unbelievable in 2 weeks, absolutely impossible in a month.
Listen to this, cried the old man, and read. And this, he said. And this chapter here, and this little novel here, it just came through, Bolton, titled The Space War, a complete novel on how it feels to fight a space war. Tom's been talking to people, soldiers, officers, men, veterans of space. He's got it all here, and here's a chapter called The Long Midnight, and here's one on the Negro colonization of Mars, and here's a character sketch of a Martian, absolutely priceless.
Bolton cleared his throat. Mr. Field.
Yes, yes, don't bother me.
I've some bad news, sir.
Field jerked his gray head up.
What? The time element?
You'd better tell Wolfe to hurry his work. The connection may break sometime this week, said Bolton softly.
I'll give you anything, anything, if you keep it going.
It's not money, Mr. Field. It's just plain physics right now. I'll do everything I can, but you'd better warn him.
The old man shriveled in his chair and was small.
But you can't take him away from me now, not when he's doing so well. You should see the outline he sent through an hour ago, the stories, the sketches. Here's one on spatial tides, another on meteors. Here's a short novel begun, called Thistledown and Fire.
I'm sorry.
If we lose him now, can we get him again?
I'd be afraid to tamper too much.
The old man was frozen.
Only one thing to do, then. Arrange to have Wolfe type his work, if possible, or dictate it, to save time, rather than have him use pencil and paper. He's got to use a machine of some sort. See to it!
The machine ticked away by the hour into the night, and into the dawn, and through the day. The old man slept only in faint dozes, blinking awake when the machine stuttered to life, and all of space and travel and existence came to him through the mind of another.
The great starred meadows of space.
The machine jumped.
Keep at it, Tom! Show them!
The old man waited. The phone rang. It was Bolton.
We can't keep it up, Mr. Field. The continuum device will absolute out within the hour.
Do something!
I can't.
The teletype chattered. In a cold fascination, in a horror, the old man watched the black lines form.
The Martian cities, immense and unbelievable, as numerous as stones thrown from some great mountain in a rushing and incredible avalanche, resting at last in shining mounds.
Tom! Cried the old man.
Now,
said Bolton on the phone. The teletype hesitated, typed a word, and fell silent.
Tom!
Screamed the old man. He shook the teletype.
It's no use, said the telephone voice. He's gone. I'm shutting off the time machine.
No, leave it on!
But
you heard me, leave it. We're not sure he's gone.
He is. It's no use. We're wasting energy.
Waste it, then.
He slammed the phone down. He turned to the teletype, to the unfinished sentence.
Come on, Tom. They can't get rid of you that way. You won't let them, will you, boy? Come on. Tom, show them you're big. You're bigger than time or space or their damned machines. You're strong, and you've a will like iron, Tom. Show them. Don't let them send you back.
The teletype snapped one key. The old man bleated,
Tom! You are there, aren't you?
Can you still write? Write, Tom, keep it coming. As long as you keep it rolling, Tom, they can't send you back.
The,
typed the machine.
More, Tom, more!
Odors of, clacked the machine.
Yes?
Mars,
typed the machine, and paused. A minute's silence. The machine spaced, skipped a paragraph, and began.
The odors of Mars, the cinnamons and cold spice winds, the winds of cloudy dust and winds of powerful bone and ancient pollen.
Tom, you're still alive!
For answer, the machine in the next 10 hours slammed out 6 chapters of Flight Before Fury in a series of fevered explosions.
Today makes 6 weeks, Bolton. 6 whole weeks, Tom gone on Mars through the asteroids. Look here, the manuscripts. 10,000 words a day he's driving himself. I don't know when he sleeps or if he eats. I don't care. He doesn't either. He only wants to get it done because he knows the time is short.
I can't understand it, said Bolton. The power failed because our relays wore out. It took us 3 days to manufacture and replace the particular channel relays necessary to keep the time element steady, and yet Wolf hung on. There's a personal factor here, Lord knows what, we didn't take into account. Wolf lives here, in this time when he is here, and can't be snapped back after all. Time isn't as flexible as we imagined. We used the wrong simile. It's not like a rubber band, more like osmosis. The penetration of membranes by liquids, from past to present. But we've got to send him back. Can't keep him here. There'd be a void there, a derangement. The one thing that really keeps him here now is himself, his drive, his desire, his work. After it's over, he'll go back as naturally as pouring water from a glass.
I don't care about reasons. All I know is Tom is finishing it. He has the old fire and description, and something else. Something more, a searching of values that supersede time and space. He's done a study of a woman left behind on Earth while the damn rocket heroes leap into space that's beautiful, objective, and subtle. He calls it Day of the Rocket, and it is nothing more than an afternoon of a typical suburban housewife who lives as her ancestral mothers lived, in a house, raising her children, her life not much different from a cave woman's. In the midst of the splendor of science and the trumpetings of space projectiles. A true and steady and subtle study of her wishes and frustrations. Here's another manuscript called The Indians, in which he refers to the Martians as Cherokees and Iroquois and Blackfoots, the Indian nations of space, destroyed and driven back. Have a drink, Bolton. Have a drink.
Tom Wolfe returned to Earth at the end of 8 weeks. He arrived in fire as he had left in fire, and his huge steps were burned across space, and in the library of Henry William Field's house were towers of yellow paper with lines of black scribble and type on them, and these were to be separated out into the 6 sections of a masterwork that, through endurance and a knowing that the sands were dwindling from the glass, had mushroomed day after day. Tom Wolfe came back to Earth and stood in the library of Henry William Field's house and looked at the massive outpourings of his heart and his hand, and when the old man said,
"Do you want to read it, Tom?"
he shook his great head and replied, putting back his thick mane of dark hair with his big pale hand,
"No, I don't dare start on it. If I did, I'd want to take it home with me, and I can't do that, can I?"
"No, Tom, you can't.
No matter how much I wanted to."
"No, that's the way it is. You never wrote another novel in that year, Tom. What was written here must stay here. What was written there must stay there. There's no touching it.
I see.
Tom sank down into a chair with a great sigh.
I'm tired. I'm mightily tired. It's been hard, but it's been good. What day is it?
This is the 56th day.
The last day?
The old man nodded, and they were both silent a while.
Back to 1938 in the Stone Cemetery, said Tom Wolfe, eyes shut. I don't like that. I wish I didn't know about that. It's a horrible thing to know.
His voice faded, and he put his big hands over his face and held them tightly there. The door opened. Bolton let himself in and stood behind Tom Wolfe's chair, a small file in his hand.
"What's that?" asked the old man.
"An extinct virus. Pneumonia. Very ancient and very evil," said Bolton. "When Mr. Wolfe came through, I had to cure him of his illness, of course, which was immensely easy with the techniques we know today in order to put him in working condition for his job, Mr. Field. I kept this pneumonia culture. Now that he's going back, he'll have to be re-inoculated with the disease."
"Otherwise?"
Tom Wolfe looked up. "Otherwise, he'd get well in 1938. Tom Wolfe arose from his chair.
"You mean, get well, walk around, back there, be well and treat the mortician?"
"That's what I mean." Tom Wolfe stared at the file, and one of his hands twitched.
"What if I destroyed the virus and refused to let you inoculate me?"
"You can't do that."
"But supposing?"
"You'd ruin things."
"What things?"
"The pattern, life, the way things are and were, the things that can't be changed. You can't disrupt it. There's only one sure thing. You're to die, and I'm to see to it." Wolfe looked at the door.
"I could run off."
"We control the machine. You wouldn't get out of the house. I'd have you back here by force and inoculated. I anticipated some such trouble when the time came. There are 5 men waiting down below. One shout from me. You see? It's useless. There, that's better. Here now." Wolfe had moved back and now had turned to look at the old man and the window in this huge house.
"I'm afraid I must apologize. I don't want to die. So very much I don't want to die."
The old man came to him and took his hand.
"Think of it this way. You've had 2 more months than anyone could expect from life. And you've turned out another book, a last book, a fine book. Think of that."
"I want to thank you for this," said Thomas Wolfe gravely. "I want to thank both of you. I'm ready."
He rolled up his sleeve.
"The inoculation."
And while Bolton bent to his task with his free hand, Thomas Wolfe penciled 2 black lines across the top of the first manuscript and went on talking.
"There's a passage from one of my old books," he said, scowling to remember it. "Of wandering forever and the earth. Who owns the earth? Did we want the earth, that we should wander on it? Did we need the earth, that we were never still upon it? Whoever needs the earth shall have the earth. He shall be upon it. He shall rest within a little place. He shall dwell in one small room forever."
Wolfe was finished with the remembering.
"Here's my last book," he said,
and on the empty yellow paper facing the manuscript he blocked out vigorous huge black letters with pressures of the pencil. "Forever and the Earth," by Thomas Wolfe. He picked up a ream of it and held it tightly in his hands, against his chest, for a moment.
"I wish I could take it back with me. It's like parting with my son."
He gave it a slap and put it aside and immediately thereafter gave his quick hand into that of his employer and strode across the room, Bolton after him. until he reached the door where he stood framed in the late afternoon light, huge and magnificent.
"Goodbye! Goodbye!"
he cried. The door slammed. Tom Wolfe was gone. They found him wandering in the hospital corridor.
"Mr. Wolfe."
"What?"
"Mr. Wolfe, you gave us a scare. We thought you were gone."
"Gone?
Where did you go?"
"Where? Where?"
He let himself be led through the midnight corridors.
"Where? Oh, if I told you where, you'd never believe."
"Here's your bed. You shouldn't have left it."
Deep into the white deathbed, which smelled of pale, clean mortality awaiting him, a mortality which had the hospital odor in it, the bed which, as he touched it, folded him into fumes and white-starched coldness. "Mars. Mars," whispered the huge man late at night.
"My best, my very best, my really fine book yet to be written, yet to be printed in another year, 3 centuries away."
"You're tired."
"Do you really think so?"
murmured Thomas Wolfe.
"Was it a dream? Perhaps. A good dream."
His breathing faltered. Thomas Wolfe was dead. In the passing years, flowers are found on Tom Wolfe's grave. And this is not unusual, for many people travel to linger there. But these flowers appear each night. They seem to drop from the sky. They are the color of an autumn moon. Their blossoms are immense, and they burn and sparkle their cold, long petals in a blue and white fire. And when the dawn wind blows, they drip away into a silver rain, a shower of white sparks on the air. Tom Wolfe has been dead many, many years, but these flowers never cease. The Better Part of Wisdom. The room was like a great warm hearth, lit by an unseen fire, gone comfortable. The fireplace itself struggled to keep a small blaze going on a few wet logs and some turf, which was no more than smoke and several lazy orange eyes of charcoal. The place was slowly filling, draining, and refilling with music. A single lemon lamp was lit in a far corner, illumining walls painted a summer color of yellow. The hardwood floor was polished so severely it glowed like a dark river upon which floated throw rugs whose plumage resembled South American wild birds, flashing electric blues, whites, and jungle greens. White porcelain vases brimming with fresh-cut hothouse flowers kept their serene fires burning on 4 small tables about the room. Above the fireplace, a serious portrait of a young man gazed out with eyes the same color as the ceramics, a deep blue, raw with intelligence and vitality. Entering the room quietly, one might not have noticed the 2 men. They were so still. One sat reclining back upon the pure white couch, eyes closed. The second lay upon the couch, so his head was pillowed in the lap of the other. His eyes were shut too, listening. Rain touched the windows. The music ended. Instantly there was a soft scratching at the door. Both men blinked as if to say, "People don't scratch, they knock." The man who had been lying down leaped to the door and called,
"Someone there?"
"By God, there is,"
said an old voice with a faint brogue.
"Grandfather!"
With the door flung wide, the young man pulled a small round old man into the warm-lit room.
"Tom, boy, ah, Tom, and glad I am to see you."
They fell together in bear hugs, pawing. Then the old man felt the other person in the room and moved back. Tom spun around, pointing.
"Grandpa, this is Frank. Frank, this is Grandpa. I mean, oh, hell.
The old man saved the moment by trotting forward to seize and pull Frank to his feet, where he towered high above this small intruder from the night.
"Frank, is it?"
the old man yelled up the heights.
"Yes, sir,"
Frank called back down.
I, said the grandfather, have been standing outside that door for 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Cried both young men, alarmed.
Debating whether to knock. I heard the music, you see, and finally I said, damn, if there's a girl with him, he can either shove her out the window in the rain or show the lovely likes of her to the old man. Hell, I said, and knocked, and...
He slung down his battered old valise.
There is no young girl here, I see. Or, by God, you've smothered her in the closet, eh?
There is no young girl, Grandfather.
Tom turned in a circle, his hands out to show.
But,
the grandfather eyed the polished floor, the white throw rugs, the bright flowers, the watchful portraits on the walls.
You've borrowed her place, then?
Borrowed?
I mean, by the look of the room, there's a woman's touch. It looks like them steamship posters I seen in the travel windows half my life.
Well, said Frank, we... The fact is, Grandfather,
said Tom, clearing his throat,
we did this place over. Redecorated.
Redecorated?
The old man's jaw dropped. His eyes toured the four walls, stunned.
The two of you are responsible? Jesus!
The old man touched a blue and white ceramic ashtray and bent to stroke a bright cockatoo throw rug.
Which of you did what?
He asked, suddenly, squinting one eye at them. Tom flushed and stammered,
Well, we...
Ah, God, no, no, stop! Cried the old man, lifting one hand. Here I am, fresh in the place, and sniffing about like a crazy hound and no fox. Shut that damn door. Ask me where I'm going. What am I up to, eh? Eh? And? Why, rat it. Do you have a touch of the beast in this art gallery?
The beast it is.
Tom slammed the door, hustled his grandfather out of his greatcoat, and brought forth three tumblers and a bottle of Irish whiskey, which the old man touched as if it were a newborn babe.
Well, that's more like it. What do we drink to?
Why, you, Grandpa.
No, no.
The old man gazed at Tom and then at his friend, Frank.
Christ,
he sighed.
You're so damn young it breaks my bones in the ache. Come now, let's drink to fresh hearts and apple cheeks and all life up ahead and happiness somewhere for the taking. Yes?
Yes,
said both, and drank. And drinking watched each other merrily or warily, half one, half the other. And the young saw in the old bright pink face, lined as it was, cuffed as it was by circumstantial life, the echo of Tom's face itself peering out through the years. In the old blue eyes, especially, was the sharp, bright intelligence that sprang from the old portrait on the wall, that would be young until coins weighted them shut. And around the edges of the old mouth was the smile that blinked and went in Tom's face, and in the old hands was the quick, surprising action of Tom's, as if both old man and young had hands that lived to themselves and did sly things by impulse. So they drank and leaned and smiled and drank again, each a mirror for the other, each delighting in the fact that an ancient man and a raw youth with the same eyes and hands and blood were met on this raining night, and the whiskey was good.
Ah, Tom, Tom, it's a loving sight you are, said the grandfather. Dublin's been sore without you these 4 years. But hell, I'm dying. No, don't ask me how or why. The doctor has the news, damn him, and shot me between the eyes with it. So I said instead of relatives shelling out their cash to come say goodbye to the old horse, why not make the farewell tour yourself and shake hands and drink drinks? So here I am this night, and tomorrow night, London, to see Lucy, and then Glasgow, to see Dick. I'll stay no more than a day each place, so as not to overload anyone. Now shut that mouth, which is hanging open. I am not out collecting sympathies. I am 80, and it's time for a damn fun wake, which I have saved money for, so not a word. I have come to see everyone, and make sure they are in a fit state of half-graceful joy so I can kick up my heels and fall dead with a good heart, if that's possible.
Grandfather,
cried Tom suddenly, and seized the old man's hands and then his shoulders.
Why, bless you, boy.
Thanks, said the old man, seeing the tears in the young man's eyes.
But just what I find in your gaze is enough.
He set the boy gently back.
Tell me about London, your work, this place. You too, Frank. A friend of Tom's is as good as my son's son. Tell everything, Tom.
Excuse me.
Frank darted toward the door.
You both have much to talk about. There's shopping I must do.
Wait!
Frank stopped, for the old man had really seen the portrait over the fireplace now and walked to it to put out his hand, to squint and read the signed name at the bottom.
Frank Davis. Is that you, boy? You did this picture?
Yes, sir,
said Frank at the door.
How long ago?
3 years ago, I think. Yes, 3.
The old man nodded slowly, as if this information added to the great puzzle, a continuing bafflement.
Tom, do you know who that looks like?
Yes, Grandad. You, a long time ago.
So you see it too, eh? Christ in heaven, yes. That's me on my 18th birthday, and all Ireland and its grasses and tender maids good for the chewing ahead, and not behind me. That's me, that's me. Jesus, I was handsome. And Jesus, Tom, so are you. And Jesus, Frank, you are uncanny. You're a fine artist, boy.
You do what you can do.
Frank had come back to the middle of the room quietly.
You do what you know.
And you know, Tom, to the hair and eyelash.
The old man turned and smiled.
How does it feel, Tom, to look out of that borrowed face? Do you feel great? Is the world your Dublin prawn and oyster?
Tom laughed. Grandfather laughed. Frank joined them.
One more drink, the old man poured, and we'll let you slip diplomatically out, Frank. But come back. I must talk with you.
What about?
Said Frank.
Oh, the mysteries of life, of time, of existence. What else did you have in mind, Frank?
Those will do, Grandfather,
said Frank, and stopped, amazed at the word come out of his mouth.
I mean, Mr. Kelly.
Grandfather will do.
I must run.
Frank doused his drink.
Phone you later, Tom.
The door shut. Frank was gone.
You'll sleep here tonight, of course, Grandpa.
Tom seized the one valise.
Frank won't be back. You'll have his bed.
Tom was busy arranging the sheets on one of the two couches against the far wall.
Now it's early. Let's drink some more, Grandfather, and talk.
But the old man, stunned, was silent, eyeing each picture in turn upon the wall.
Grand painting, that.
Frank did them.
That's a fine lamp there.
Frank made it.
The rug on the floor here now?
Frank.
Jesus, whispered the old man. He's a maniac for work, is he not?
Quietly he shuffled about the room like one visiting a gallery.
It seems, he said, the place is absolutely blown apart with fine artistic talent. You turned your hand to nothing like this in Dublin.
You learn a lot away from home,
said Tom uneasily. The old man shut his eyes and drank his drink.
Is anything wrong, Grandfather?
It will hit me in the middle of the night, said the old man. I will probably stand up in bed with a hell of a yell. But right now it is just a thing in the pit of my stomach and the back of my head. Let's talk, boy. Let's talk.
And they talked and drank until midnight. And then the old man got put to bed and Tom went to bed himself, and after a long while both slept. About 2 in the morning the old man woke suddenly. He peered around in the dark, wondering where he was, then saw the paintings, the upholstered chairs, and the lamp and rugs Frank had made, and sat up. He clenched his fists. Then, rising, he threw on his clothes and staggered toward the door as if fearful that he might not make it before something terrible happened. When the door slammed, Tom jerked his eyes wide. Somewhere off in the dark, there was a sound of someone calling, shouting, defying the elements. Someone at the top of his lungs crying blasphemies, saying God and Jesus and God, and finally blows struck, wild blows as if someone were hitting a wall or a person. After a long while, his grandfather shuffled back into the room, soaked to the skin. Weaving, muttering, whispering, the old man peeled off his wet clothes before the fireless fire, then threw a newspaper on the coals, which blazed up briefly to show a face relaxing out of fury into numbness. The old man found and put on Tom's discarded robe. Tom kept his eyes tight as the old man held his hands out toward the dwindling blaze streaked with blood.
Damn. 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 There.
He poured whiskey and gulped it down. He blinked at Tom and the paintings on the wall and looked at Tom and the flowers and the vases and then drank again. After a long while, Tom pretended to wake up.
It's after 2. You need your rest, Granda.
I'll rest when I'm done drinking. And thinking.
Thinking what, Grandpa?
Right now, said the old man, seated in the dim room with the tumbler in his two hands, and the fire gone to ghost on the hearth. Remembering your dear grandmother in June of the year 1902. And there is the thought of your father born, which is fine, and you born after him, which is fine. And there is the thought of your father dying when you were young, and the hard life of your mother, and her holding you too close, maybe, in the cold beggar life of flinty Dublin. And me out in the meadows with my work and life, and us together only once a month. The being born of people and the going away of people. These turn round in an old man's night. I think of you born, Tom, a happy day. And I see you here now. That's it.
The old man grew silent and drank his drink.
Granda,
said Tom at last, almost like a child crept in for penalties and forgiveness of a sin as yet unnamed.
Do I worry you?
No,
then the old man added.
But what life will do with you, how you may be treated, good or ill. I sit up late with that.
The old man sat. The young man lay wide-eyed, watching him, and later said, as if reading thoughts,
Grandfather, I am happy.
The old man leaned forward.
Are you, boy? I have never been so happy in my life, sir.
Yes.
The old man looked through the dim air of the room at the young face.
I see that. But will you stay happy, Tom?
Does anyone ever stay happy, Grandfather? Nothing lasts, does it?
Shut up, your grandma and me. That lasted.
No, it wasn't all the same, was it? The first years were one thing, the last years another.
The old man put his hand over his own mouth and then massaged his face, closing his eyes.
God, yes, you're right. There are 4 lives for each of us. Not one of them lasts, it's sure, but the thought of them does. And out of the 4 or 5 or 12 lives you live, one is special. I remember once.
The old man's voice faltered. The young man said,
Once, Grandpa?
The old man's eyes fixed somewhere to a horizon of the past. He did not speak to the room or to Tom or to anyone. He didn't even seem to be speaking to himself.
Oh, it was a long time ago. When I first came in this room tonight, for no reason, strange, the memory was there. I ran back down along the shoreline of Galway to that week.
What week? When?
My 12th birthday fell that week in summer. Think of it! Victoria still queen and me in a turf hut, out by Galway strolling the shore for food to be picked up from the tides, and the weather so sweet you almost turned sad with the taste of it, for you knew it would soon go away. and in the middle of the great fair weather, along the road by the shore, one noon came this tinker's caravan carrying their dark gypsy people to set up camp by the sea. There was a mother, a father, and a girl in that caravan, and this boy who came running down by the sea alone, perhaps in need of company, for there I was with nothing to do, and in need of strangers myself. Here he came running, and I shall not forget my first sight of him from that day till they drop me in the earth. He... Ah, God, I'm a failure with words. Stop everything. I must go further back. A circus came to Dublin. I visited the sideshows of pinheads and dwarfs and terrible small midgets and fat women and skeleton men. Seeing a crowd about one last exhibit, I thought, this must be the most horrible of all. I edged over to look at this final terror. And what did I see? The crowd was drawn to nothing more nor less than a little girl of some 6 years, so fair, so beautiful, so cream white of cheek, so blue of eye, so golden of hair, so quiet in her manner that in the midst of this fleshy holocaust she called attention. By saying nothing, her shout of beauty stopped the show. All had to come to her to get well again, for it was a sick menagerie, and she the only sweet, lovely doc about to give us back life. Well, that girl in the sideshow was as wonderful a surprise as this boy come running down the beach like a young horse. He was not dark like his parents. His hair was all gold curls and bits of sun. He was cut out of bronze by the light, and what wasn't bronze was copper. Impossible, but it seemed that this boy of 12, like myself, had been born on that very day. He looked that new and fresh. And in his face were these bright brown eyes, the eyes of an animal that has run a long way, pursued along the shorelines of the world. He pulled up, and the first thing he said to me was laughter. He was glad to be alive, and announced that, by the sound he made, I must have laughed in turn, for his spirit was catching. He shoved out his brown hand. I hesitated. He gestured impatiently and grabbed my hand. My God, after all these years I remember what he said. Isn't it funny? He said. I didn't ask what was funny, I knew. He said his name was Joe. I said my name was Tim. And there we were, two boys, on the beach, and the universe a good rare joke between us. He looked at me with his great round full copper eyes and laughed out his breath, and I thought, he has chewed hay. His breath smells of grass. And suddenly I was giddy. The smell stunned me. Jesus God, I thought, reeling, I'm drunk, and why? I've nipped Dad's booze, but God, what's this? Drunk by noon, hit by the sun, giddy from what? The sweet mash caught in a strange boy's teeth? No, no. Then Joe looked straight at me and said, there isn't much time. Much time? I asked. Why, said Joe, for us to be friends. We are, aren't we? He breathed the smell of mown fields upon me. Jesus God, I wanted to cry. Yes, and almost fell down but staggered back, as if he had hit me a friend's hit, and my mouth opened and shut, and I said, why is there so little time? Because, said Joe, we'll only be here 6 days, 7 at the most. Then on down and around Eire. I'll never see you again in my life, so we'll just have to pack a lot of things in a few days, won't we, Tim? 6 days? That's no time at all, I protested, and wondered why I found myself suddenly destroyed, left destitute on the shore. A thing had not begun, but already I sorrowed after its death. A day here, a week there, a month somewhere else, said Joe. I must live very quickly, Tim.
I have no friends that last, only what I remember. So wherever I go, I say to my new friends, quick, do this, do that. Let us make many happenings, a long list, so you will remember me when I am gone. And I you, and say, that was a friend. So, let's begin. There. And Joe tagged me and ran. I ran after him laughing, for wasn't it silly me headlong after a stranger boy unknown 5 minutes before? We must have run a mile down that long summer beach before he let me catch him. I thought I might pummel him for making me run so far for nothing, for something, for God knew what. But when we tumbled to earth and I pinned him down, all he did was spring his breath in one gasp up at me, one breath, and I leaped back and shook my head and sat staring at him, as if I'd plunged wet hands in an open electric socket. He laughed to see me fall away, to see me scurry and sit and wonder. Tim, he said, we shall be friends. You know the dread long cold weather most months of Ireland? Well, this week of my 12th birthday, it was summer each day and every day for the 7 days named by Joe as the limit which would be no more days. We walked the shore, and that's all there was. The simple thing of us upon the shore, the building castles or climbing hills to fight wars among the mounds. We found an old round tower and yelled up and down from it, but mostly it was walking, our arms about each other like twins born in a tangle, never cut free by knife or lightning. I inhaled, he exhaled. Then we breathed, and I was the sweet chorus. We talked, far through the night, on the sand, until our parents came seeking the lost, who had found they knew not what. Lured home, I slept beside him, or him me, and talked and laughed, Jesus, laughed, till dawn. Then out again we roared until the earth swung up to hit our backs. We found ourselves laid out with sweet hilarity, eyes tight, gripped to each other's, shaking. And the laugh jumped free like one silver trout following another. God, I bathed in his laughter, and he bathed in mine, until we were weak, as if love had put us to the slaughter and exhaustions. We panted then like pups in hot summer, empty of laughing, and sleepy with friendship. And the weather for that week was blue and gold, no clouds, no rain, and a wind that smelled of apples, but no, only that boy's wild breath. It crossed my mind, long after, if ever an old man could bathe again in that summer fount, the wild spout of breathing that sprang from his nostrils and gasped from his mouth, why, one might peel off a score of years. One would be young. How might the flesh resist? But the laughter is gone, and the boy gone into a man lost somewhere in the world, and here I am 2 lifetimes later, speaking of it for the first time. For who was there to tell? From my 12th birthday week, and the gift of friendship, to this, who might I tell of that shore, and that summer, and the two of us, walking all tangled in our arms and lives, and life as perfect as the letter O, a damned great circle of rare weather, lovely talk, and us certain we'd live forever, never die, and be good friends. And at the end of the week he left. He was wise for his years. He didn't say goodbye. All of a sudden, the tinker's cart was gone. I shouted along the shore. A long way off, I saw the caravan go over a hill. But then his wisdom spoke to me. Don't catch. Let go. Weep now, my own wisdom said. And I wept. I wept for 3 days, and on the 4th grew very still. I did not go down to the shore again for many months. And in all the years that have passed, never have I known such a thing again. I have had a good life, a fine wife, good children, and you, boy, Tom, you. But as sure as I sit here, Never after that was I so agonized, mad, and crazy wild. Never did drink make me as drunk. Never did I cry so hard again. Why, Tom? Why do I say this? And what was it? Back so far in innocence, back in the time when I had nobody and knew nothing. How is it I remember him when all else slips away? When often I cannot remember your dear grandmother's face, God forgive me. Why does his face come back on the shore by the sea? Why do I see us fall again, and the earth reach up to take the wild young horses driven mad by too much sweet grass in a line of days that never end?
The old man grew silent. After a moment he added,
The better part of wisdom, they say, is what's left unsaid. I'll say no more. I don't even know why I've said all this.
Tom lay in the dark.
I know. Do you, lad?
Asked the old man.
Well, tell me.
Someday.
Someday, said Tom. I will.
They listened to the rain touch at the windows.
Are you happy, Tom? You asked that before, sir. I ask again. Are you happy? Yes.
Silence.
Is it summertime on the shore, Tom? Is it the magic 7 days? Are you drunk?
Tom did not answer for a long while, and then said nothing but,
Granda,
and then moved his head once in a nod. The old man lay back in the chair. He might have said, This will pass. He might have said, It will not last. He might have said many things. Instead, he said,
Tom, sir.
Ah, oh, Jesus, shouted the old man suddenly. Christ, God Almighty, damn it to hell.
Then the old man stopped and his breathing grew quiet.
There. It's a maniac night. I had to let out one last yell. I just had to, boy.
And at last they slept, with the rain falling fast. With the first light of dawn, the old man dressed with careful quietness, picked up his valise, and bent to touch the sleeping young man's cheek with the palm of one hand.
Tom, goodbye,
he whispered. Moving down the dim stairwell toward the steadily beating rain, he found Tom's friend waiting at the foot of the stairs.
Frank, you haven't been down here all night.
No, Mr. Kelly, said Frank quickly. I stayed at a friend's.
The old man turned to look up the dark stairwell, as if he could see the room and Tom in it, warm asleep.
Gah!
Something almost a growl stirred in his throat and subsided. He shifted uneasily and looked back down at the dawn kindled on this young man's face, this one who had painted a picture that hung above the fireplace in the room above.
The damn night is over, said the old man. So if you'll just stand aside.
Sure.
The old man took one step down and burst out.
Listen, if you hurt Tom in any way ever, why, Jesus, I'll break you across my knee. You hear?
Frank held out his hand.
Don't worry.
The old man looked at the hand as if he had never seen one before. He sighed.
Ah, oh, damn it to hell, Frank, Tom's friend. Saw young your destruction to the eyes. Get away.
They shook hands.
Jesus, that's a hard grip, said the old man, surprised.
Then he was gone, as if the rain had hustled him off in its own multitudinous running. The young man shut the upstairs door and stood for a moment looking at the figure on the bed, and at last went over and, as if by instinct, put his hand down to the exact same spot where the old man had printed his hand in farewell not 5 minutes before. He touched the summer cheek. In his sleep, Tom smiled the smile of his father's father and called the old man, deep in a dream, by name. He called him twice. And then he slept, quietly.